speaks for session. My name is Shasta DeBrow. I'm a faculty member in the management group, specifically in the employment relations and organizational behavior group. So you're going to get that little flavor of what management is all about today. But before we get started, I'm really curious to learn a little bit more about you guys and where you're from, because I know some of you have been traveling in. Who thinks they've come from the farthest away to be here? Anyone come from another continent altogether? Come in, sit down. There's plenty of seats right up here where I can chit chat with you. Anyone come from another continent, or are you all from Europe? All Europe? Who's from Europe somewhere, including the UK? Anyone travel from North America? No? Asia? You came all the way for this?
Yes.
Wow, bravo, welcome. Okay, well, I won't harass you too much more, quizzing you where you're from, but welcome. I'm thrilled to see all of you here and give you a bit of a taster. And I'll be talking about a topic, listen to your heart, calling and receptivity to career advice, and I'll tell you more about what that means in just a moment. So why a taster session? What is this about? So as you may know, the BSc in management is similar and different from other programs, both at LSE and to other universities that you might be considering. So compared to other LSE programs, how are we similar? Well, we offer some similar courses as what you would have from other programs, including you'll get economics, math, statistics, accounting, and finance. So there is overlap. But what's distinctive about our BSc in management is that you also will get some really great courses in operations management, marketing, and organizational behavior. If you guys come on in, there are plenty of seats up here. Don't be shy. I've had to stand through lectures in here, and it's no fun, so please come sit down. And so as I mentioned, I am from organizational behavior, so you're going to get a little bit of a taste from this one little specific aspect of what we do here. And as you know, at least the last couple of years, I've been co-teaching MG102 here, which is our intro organizational behavior course. So I don't know what I'm teaching yet next year, but chances are, if you decide to come here, you'll get me. I'll get to see you in class in the fall. Okay, so why else about this taster session? Well, hopefully it can give you a little taste of a topic like you might encounter in our program here. And specifically, I picked this topic that we'll be talking about with calling and receptivity to career advice for two reasons. One, I'm going to be presenting some research that I've done, and this is something that's very exciting about being at the LSE, where all of your faculty are like me in terms of being very research-oriented. That's how we get hired. We get hired because we like to teach and we like to do research. And so in all of your classes, the way we'll teach is truly informed by doing rigorous theory-based research. And that will really provide a lot of strength for what you're learning. But I think one of the cool things about management in particular is that the topics that we teach about and you'll be learning about are also relevant to you. And so today, please come and take a seat. And so in particular, we're talking about something like career advice. How many of you have been getting career advice, both solicited and unsolicited, this spring as you're contemplating where to go to university? Are you guys getting a lot of advice? So hopefully this topic will be directly relevant to you and your life. But it is based on research that I've done, so it's rigorous, it's published in a journal, and that's the way you'll learn here. It's rigorous, but relevant. Rigorous and relevant. Also, I want to encourage you, please ask questions along the way. I like my classes to be very participatory and interactive. So if you have any questions, raise your hand. I can ask you to say things, so don't be shy. Again, you'll see variety in that across courses here at LSE. You'll be able to tell from my voice I'm American, and I come out of the American university system where things are meant to be very interactive, not like formal, you know, separation between students and lecturers. So any questions yet? Bring it on. Come on. Someone have a question?
Which university?
What?
Which university did you go to?
I got my undergrad and PhD at Harvard. Thanks for asking. Why is that funny? No, I mean, it's a great question, and I think, again, I'm here just as a representative of our faculty. Your faculty here are amazing. We all work really hard. We love teaching you guys. We think that it's exciting to teach students that are from all over the world. And they're smart and work hard. So, you know, it's a great place to be in that regard. Okay, so let's get started. And again, please interrupt with questions. So I want to give you a little bit of the phenomenon that inspired me to do this research that I hope, again, is very relevant to you. Are any of you musical theater fans by any chance? Any of you, do you even know musical theater? Broadway, West End? Any of you like that stuff? Anyone? Does anyone know what a chorus line is? Have you seen a chorus Okay, it's a famous Broadway or West End musical. Now, I can tell you the story, it doesn't matter. I won't tell you, I promise. So this is a musical that's about these aspiring performers who are auditioning to be on stage. And the musical ends up telling stories of each of these people and kind of the backstory and how they ended up there and their dreams and goals of ending up on the stage. And so there's a song sung by this character named Diana Morales. And in the song, she's reflecting back on when she was in high school, which is what most of you guys are in right now, or whatever you call it here, sixth form. So, whatever, you know, she's sixth form. Why am I laughing? I don't know. Someone.
No, it's sixth form.
That's right? All right. Well, you can call me out later. Anyway, so she's reflecting back on when she was around your age. She was attending classes at a performing arts high school. So she was at the specialist school. And on the very first day of the acting class, the teacher says to her, you should transfer to a regular high school. You shouldn't be at this performing arts high school, even though she was dying to become an actress. And so she's saying how humiliating it was for the teacher to basically give her this really discouraging advice, like, you're never going to make it. You should just give up now. So then by the end of the song, she's singing about how she overcame this. And she sings and says, you know, a voice from down at the bottom of her soul said, this man, the teacher is nothing. This course is nothing. If you want something, go find another class. And when you find one, you'll be an actress. And I assure you that's what finally came to pass. So the point is, she decided to disregard this advice from the teacher who said, you're never going to make it. And she just went for it anyway and achieved her dream of becoming an actress. And so this is what inspired me to do some research. I also happen to be a professional musician, so I've spent a lot of my life in the world of the arts, and it's a career area where people have a lot of trouble ever making it. And that's something probably different than what a lot of you are thinking about coming to a management program where you're thinking, management might be really good for getting a job someday. Well, think about the opposite scenario, which is what these folks encounter. And so, again, this sets the stage for what this research is about. And I'm curious to ask you guys, have you ever had examples of people offering to you or where you've been receiving, have you ever had examples of where you're offering or receiving discouraging career advice? Just like show of hands, have any of you gotten discouraging career advice ever? Like someone says, don't do this? Some of you? Have any of you offered discouraging career advice? Maybe you'll tell your classmates, like, don't come to this program, it sucks. No, don't do that. Okay, so keep these examples in the back of your mind as we go along. Think about the character from A Chorus Line who received this discouraging career advice, but she decided to go for it anyway. So who listens to this kind of advice? Who decides to follow it? Why? This is what inspired me to do some of this research. And as I mentioned, I'm a musician, and I was really curious from all my involvement in the world of music, you know, why do people go into these kind of crazy career paths that are pretty impractical compared to something like what you guys are contemplating? Why do people go into career paths where the chances of ever making it are so low? And so I set out to do this huge, well, I didn't know it was huge when I started, but I've done this huge study since 2001, and I assume all of you were at least born in 2001, right? But how old were you guys in 2001? Like five? Right, so I've been doing this study since then, which is now officially making me feel old. But I've been collecting data from people that at this time were young musicians who were actually right around your age, or a little younger. They were on average around 17 when I started collecting data from them. And I've been following them for many years, collecting a lot of survey data and a lot of interview data from several hundred of them. These are very talented young musicians, and I've been following them into now their late 20s, seeing what happens in their lives. And so this is called a longitudinal study. Does anyone know what longitudinal means? Yeah.
Study carried out over a long period of time.
Yeah, and it goes above and beyond that. It's following the same people over time. So I'm collecting data from these, you know, these 17-year-olds, and then I keep collecting data from those same people again and again and again. So this is a huge study. It's amazing data. And this research on career advice is just one piece of this overall data set. Okay, so why am I studying things related to career advice with musicians, besides the fact that I, you know, have seen it up close myself? Well, it's a tough career path. And for people contemplating going into really any career path, but perhaps especially tough career path, it might really pay to listen to good advice, right? You, I'm sure, asking for lots of help, trying to figure out what university to go to. Hopefully you're thinking about, like, who do I want to listen to? Who do I trust? Who can give me good information? So that should help. And for musicians, it should be especially important because every year in the U.S., at least, There are about 3,000 orchestra players who graduate every year, and every year there are about 150 job openings. And you guys in the back, I can see you straining, but you may not even be able to see that there's anything here. So the point here, it doesn't even matter what instrument, anything. The fact is, there are tons and tons of kids graduating with degrees where there are very few job openings. So this is a tough career path. They should be listening to good career advice, right? But they don't. So the research question I focus on is, what is going on in the minds of young people who choose to go into a career path like this? And isn't anyone telling them not to? And so the way that we translate these kind of real-world research questions into an academic research study is we have to figure out kind of how do we measure these things, what do we call these kinds of constructs. And here, I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about people's sense of calling, and I'll define that for you in a minute. But that's sort of the what's going on in their minds, and we're going to look at the relationship between that and how receptive people are to actual discouraging or negative career advice. Questions yet? You're welcome to raise your hands. Don't be scared. Okay, so the more focused research question, so what the question I'm asking in this study is, what is the relationship between someone's sense of calling and their receptivity to receiving negative career advice? Okay? So, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the theoretical background and some definitions. We do two studies. We collect a lot of data to address these questions, and then we'll wrap up with some discussion and conclusions. Okay, so what's a calling? Have you guys ever heard this word before? So it's actually pretty new. This is my primary area of research, actually, and it's still pretty new in organizational behavior. So it's a fun area to work with. It's not an old area like some other things you'll end up learning about in school here. So in work I've done and published with one of my co-authors, we define calling as a consuming, meaningful passion that you can experience toward a domain. So think of it as like this little star in your head. It's something inside of you. It's psychological. But you experience toward a domain, like toward music, or toward management, or toward social enterprise, or whatever it may be. And we know how to measure this, et cetera, and I'll tell you more about that later. And in my research and in colleagues' research, we see that people with very strong callings, so people that are very consumed by what they do, they think it's very meaningful, they're very passionate about it, they may experience some sense of career tunnel vision, meaning that they're over-focusing on how they feel, they're over-focusing on their own self-perceptions, and they're perhaps under-focusing on external information, meaning like basically they're obsessed. I'm so into doing music that I don't care if someone's going to tell me bad career advice. I've just got my blinders up, I've got tunnel vision going on. So that's kind of the premise we're working with here. Does that make sense so far? Okay, great. So, if we're asking this kind of question, we need to provide some sort of theoretical basis for it. So we look to the academic literature, you know, to find out what have other people studied, how can we argue for what we think is going on. So why would people be unreceptive to negative career advice? Any guesses? Like, why wouldn't you want to hear if someone says, no, you can't do it, you're not going to succeed in doing this thing you really want to do? Why?
Because their sense of life is to succeed in their field. And
yeah.
If someone just tells them that there's no sense to continue, then problems in their life wouldn't have sense either.
Yeah, so that can be very upsetting, right? If someone tells you, you know, you can't do something that you have set as an important goal for yourself. Any other guesses of like what research might have looked at for why people might not be receptive to negative career advice in particular?
Lack of trust.
Yeah, so it's going to depend on who is this advice coming from, right? Is it from someone that you generally trust, someone you don't trust? Or even if it's from a trusted person, if it's negative, do you automatically distrust it? These are open questions. Any other guesses?
Yeah. Possibly because you believe that when it came down to it, finally, like if you want to be a musician, you believe that the people at the top of the industry would think you were good, whereas people telling you you're not worth it right now, you want to disregard that completely and hopefully think that they don't know what they're talking about, basically. Just
you just want to dismiss it. So that kind of goes along with this trust that you're very motivated to not want to trust them, right? You want to disregard it because your own self-belief is, I'm really amazing, right? You don't want to believe someone else telling you that you're not. Yeah.
You only live once.
So we need to screw all these other people and just go for it. Fair enough, right? Okay, so what we do know from existing research, this is not research I've done, you'll see. Have you guys ever seen little things like this listed after statements like in academic materials? This is where I'm basically citing someone else's article. So this is the authors the year was published, and so you'll see that in a lot of your faculty slides here, and also once you start reading academic articles. So negative feedback can be viewed as what you guys were saying. It can be viewed as idiosyncratic to the person providing the feedback. It's like, I'm not going to listen to this feedback from you because you're just weird, and I'm not going to listen to you. Right? But you're not. You're amazing. So maybe listen to your advice. Maybe you wouldn't listen to my advice, for example. So be it. Okay. Another thing you guys brought up. Negative feedback can just be viewed as more inaccurate. Like, this has to be wrong if someone is giving me this discouraging feedback. And as you guys also highlighted, it can be threatening to your self-concept. So in your organizational behavior classes, we're basically psychologists. So you're going to hear a lot of terms like this that sound very psychological, and self-concept is basically just how you view yourself. So these are some of the reasons, and here's a little cartoon that highlights this. It says, I think Jim is a little sensitive to negative feedback, and says loser. So, okay. So, yeah, all of us are sensitive to being called things like losers, right? Okay, so we're arguing that all of these things may be especially true for people with strong degrees of calling. Remember, these are people that feel consumed, passionate, and find a lot of meaning in what they do. And we think that that basically may exacerbate or make more extreme all of these effects. There's some other reasons that we know as well that may explain why people are more unreceptive to negative feedback. We know that higher self-efficacy is linked to less receptivity to negative feedback. So self-efficacy is another psychology term that is basically about self-confidence. So we know that the more confident you are, the less receptive you are to this negative feedback. So it goes a little bit to you like, I only told them once, like I'm so confident, like I don't need to listen to all this. And then the research that my colleague and I have done, we know that a sense of calling is linked to a specific form of self-efficacy, which is career-related self-efficacy, which is how confident you feel in being able to do the things you want in your career in particular. And so kind of, these are loose logical connections, but we make the argument that calling should also be linked to less receptivity to negative feedback because of this connection with self-efficacy. Questions or comments on this? Okay. So, these are hypotheses, which are pretty straightforward in this project, which is that we think that the stronger your degree of calling toward a particular domain, the more likely you will be to ignore negative career advice. So if I've got this very strong calling, I'm really going to ignore negative feedback. And we look at this over time. So our hypotheses are this effect will happen in the short term, the medium term, and the long term. And I'll show you what that looks like in just a moment. Okay, so in study one, I used the data from the musicians I told you about a few minutes ago. We used 7 years' worth of data, so this is spanning from when these guys in the study were about 17 through 24 years old. There are about 450 of them in the base sample. And during this stage of their life, they're transitioning from high school to college or university, which is what we call, you guys call college high school here. In the U.S., we call college university. Anyway, okay, into postgraduate life. So you understand they're 17 through 24. And in terms of our hypotheses, the short term spans 6 weeks, the medium term spans 3.5 years, and the long term spans 7 years. And I just want to highlight that in a lot of research you'll see in organizational behavior, people collect all their data at one time. So they'll collect a survey from you right now, and they'll analyze that. But that's a lot different than looking at how things relate over time. In fact, the mission statement of the LSC is something about like understanding the causes of things over time or understanding the causes of things. Longitudinal research actually really helps do that in a far more rigorous way than a lot of other styles of research. So keep your eye on that as you spend more time around here. Okay, so we collected all this data. We ran all these fancy statistical analyses, which I'm not going to show you right now, but I'm happy to talk to you about offline if you're interested. And voila, we found that these effects hold over all the time periods, meaning the stronger your degree of calling, the more likely you are to ignore negative career advice. And in particular, I want to show you how we interpreted these findings in terms of the magnitude of the results, like how big of an effect did we find. We found a pretty big effect. We found that people with strong callings on our measure, we have a measure that we've developed to measure calling on a survey. People with strong callings actually ignore potentially useful career advice. And we focused on trust, actually, so the way we phrased the questions were about receiving career advice from a very trusted mentor. So it wasn't just like you ignore career advice from a random person. It was how well do you receive career advice from a trusted person. So strong calling people actually ignore. Weak calling people actually follow the teacher's advice. So it's that extreme in terms of the empirical analyses that strong-calling people ignore advice, weak-calling people follow the advice. And we also saw that these effects endured over time and across different career stages. So we were pretty excited about all this, and we decided we need to be really rigorous. Like, that's already very rigorous in terms of our data and our analyses, but we thought, okay, we need to really nail this down. We need to look at a different sample of people, not just musicians. And so the fancy term we'll use for trying to study something in two different contexts is generalizability. So it means what it sounds like. Do our results from this one setting generalize, meaning are they the same in another setting? So we want to look at a contrasting sample. So who did we look at? We looked at business students, much like you guys, right? So we want to see what happens with their degree of calling and their willingness to listen to a trusted mentor. So this is just a single-way survey setting. You know, we just collected the data once. We just wanted to see, do these basic relationships that we're interested in still work or not? Okay, so the same hypothesis, is calling related to ignoring career advice? So what do you guys think happened in this sample? Do you think we replicated our results? I think we got the opposite? Got nothing? It ended up being the same. So even when we're measuring business and management students' degree of calling for business or management, the stronger their calling, the more likely they were to ignore negative career advice. And again, interpreting the magnitude of the results, we found the exact same thing as with the musician. We found that if they got strong callings, as we measure it, they are likely to ignore potentially useful career advice, and if they have a weak calling, they will follow the advice. It's that extreme on our measures. And it's actually rare to find results that truly spread people from, you know, into separate categories, like following something and ignoring something. So what does all this mean? Well, to summarize this, first of all, most research out there on calling, which is this consuming, meaningful passion that people experience, most people assume that that's a really good thing. A lot of people use phrases like, go find your calling, and if you find your calling, you'll love life. And I love to focus more on the dark side and look at the risks of what can happen when you're basically obsessed with what you're doing. But we're seeing here that there may be this risk to people. They've got a very strong calling. They're ignoring information from a trusted advisor. Now again, I'm not here to say that it's a bad thing to ignore advice, but it's just a descriptive finding. Also, our results are longitudinal, meaning we're tracking people over time, seeing what's really happening to them in their lives. And we see that calling is predicting this really interesting mentoring-related outcome over time. And then in terms of receptivity to career advice, one thing my co-author and I were intrigued to find is that there's no research out there on receptivity to career advice. Even though most of us spend our lives, especially at your stage where you're trying to figure out what to do for university, maybe in a few years we'll be trying to figure out what to do for your first job, we spend tons of time asking for career advice, receiving career advice, figuring out what to do with all this. There's no research on this. So we were intrigued that this paper we published is actually the first published research we can find on this notion of how well do people actually receive career advice. And so there are a bunch of implications here for people, especially to have the stronger callings. So if you are a person that has a strong calling, what does this mean? Well, it may be a very good thing to pursue and fulfill a calling over time, but these folks can really lose out in winner-takes-all markets. So these markets where tons of people are coming in, and this is actually more of an economics thing, so this is my nod to my colleagues, you know, in another building here that do economics. When you've got markets like the musician space, so like professional athlete space, where there are tons and tons of young people trying to enter this market, it's kind of like a pyramid at the top, these people with strong callings really can't lose out because they're never going to make it. But is it worth trying? Like, I remain agnostic on that. We also know that people with strong callings can be vulnerable to a number of bad things in organizations. This is from research, some really great research on zookeepers, and they found that zookeepers who have strong callings are vulnerable to overwork, low pay, and other forms of mistreatment from management. So again, these are risk factors that people with strong callings can experience. And so maybe people with strong callings should consider alternatives, right? Perhaps you can pursue your calling part-time or as an amateur, or maybe if you have multiple talents, maybe you pursue your more practical talent professionally and pursue music or whatever it may be, you know, in a more casual way. You know, there are a lot of different ways to think about this. Then, let's say you're a counselor or an advisor to people with strong callings. What do you do, given the kind of research I've been talking about? Like, how do you give advice to the people that are most likely to feel threatened by it? So think about it. You come to my office to ask me for advice on what you should do with your life, and you've got a very strong calling. How am I supposed to handle you knowing that you're actually most likely to feel threatened if I tell you not to do something, you may ignore it, etc.? For these counselors or advisors, discouraging feedback might directly conflict with something that the advisee has been experiencing in a very passionate way for a long, long time. How do you manage that? And, you know, what kind of career advice do you give to students? It can be very conflicting to go through that. Do you tell people, pursue your dreams? Or do you tell them, be realistic, pick something pragmatic? I mean, how many of you have people in your life telling you, you know, pursue your dreams? That kind of, you know, pursue your passion, do what you love. Wow, not that many. How many of you work here and go, like, be realistic, pick something practical? How many of you are getting no career advice whatsoever? Okay, I can't tell what you guys are reacting to. I guess I may be reflecting a little bit more of an American. Like, well, career values do vary across countries. And I think in the U.S., we have a lot of this kind of things going on. So people really have a strong belief in, like, going after what their dreams are, what they love. And they sometimes forget to also think about what it means to be realistic. So there's just a balancing act there. And, you know, again, if you're a teacher or an advisor, how do you continue to teach and support a student who may be ignoring what you're telling them to do? Okay, lastly, think about institutions like the LSC or like the music conservatories that train music students. What can institutions do when they've got a lot of strong calling people around? Like, how do you present a realistic message to students? Like, what is the responsibility? Like, what's our responsibility in telling you guys about the job market? You know, that's an open question. So the institutions can do things like provide self-assessment opportunities, things like career centers, career courses, things that can help students actually reflect and learn, and also expose students to a breadth of role models. So, you know, if all of you are coming in saying, like, the only thing I want to do after getting a management degree is become a management consultant, maybe it would benefit you guys as a cohort to be exposed to not only management consultants, but also, you know, people who run startups and people who are CEOs and people who are management professors and, you know, all sorts of different ways of using a degree in these kind of ways. And that can hopefully provide students with some creativity in thinking about their futures. So to wrap up, you know, the title of this project was Listening to Your Heart, and I want to end with a quote from a participant in my research who is an aspiring triple threat, which means that she's someone who wants to be a dancer, a singer, and an actress. And she said, "My choir teacher says, please, please don't be a professional. All I hear is how hard it is, and I see how hard they live. I keep doing it. I keep trying to sing and do all this stuff because I love it so much. They discourage me from doing it, but they still help me." So this is, you know, this kind of highlights what my research is all about. How does someone juggle this conflicting set of things going on in their lives where they're feeling very passionate about something, but they know that it may be rough going? So do they listen to their hearts, or do they listen to something else? So that's the end of what I have to present to you right on schedule. Do you guys have questions about this research, about how it fits into organizational behavior, the program? Yeah.
How would you measure the strength of someone's calling?
I think I have some slides in here, actually. Okay, so we have a 12-item scale that we developed and have published, and I'm happy to talk more offline about how it is that you develop a measure. We jumped through all these hoops and collected huge amounts of data and tons of statistics to be able to say that this is measuring what we think it's measuring. We have 12 items that we rate on a survey, and it's things like, I'm passionate about playing my instrument. I would sacrifice everything to be a musician. Even when not playing music, I have to think about music. And I'll say, if you guys come to LSC and take MG102 with me, and I'm still teaching it next year, you'll actually get to take this survey as part of it, but it's about management, not about music. Or if you're interested in that, I'm happy to send it to you as well. Other questions? Yeah?
In relation to organizational behavior, So what's the main thing?
So why is this organizational behavior?
Yeah,
that's a great question. I'm glad you asked me to clarify that. So the study of careers is part of organizational behavior. So organizational behavior is basically about the study of people and work. And sometimes, as you can see from this research, there's not much about organizations here, right? These people that I'm studying coming out of organizations, they're musicians, they're getting jobs in orchestras, you know, there is an organizational influence going on. They're being trained in organizations, but the focus is more on the individual. So what you'll see in your OB, we call it OB, your OB classes is you'll learn about things ranging from things that are going on inside of our heads all the way up to things that are much more what we would call macro, which is about the organizations themselves, how organizations relate to one another, and everything in between, which would be things like teams and stuff like that. So yeah, so like I said, this is one taste of one little spot within organizational behavior, which is just one thing within management. Mm-hmm. So just, that's why it's truly a taster session. Yeah.
Have you researched how people tend to end up when they do listen? Whenever there's a strong calling and still, I don't know, for whatever reasons, listen to advice and just give up the dream?
So I don't know, I don't have data on that in particular. I do have a lot of data on what actually happens to these people that are in my big study. And what we do see is that the people with the strong callings are the ones who end up making it into music or end up working professionally as musicians, at least when they're in their late 20s, which is how old they are right now in their life. The thing is, so that's a good thing, right? At least for wanting to understand how callings work. But the problem is that there is still a winner takes all market, it's still that pyramid. So there are many other people with strong callings who are not making it. So I don't have a direct answer about what happens with the career advice itself over time. But I do know that callings do predict career behaviors over time.
But are there people who have a very strong callings and still decide to give up?
Of course. Tons of them, because and some of that depends on the labor market, because there's just not room for them. So I know plenty of musicians, at least, and you can think of this in other contexts as well. Plenty of musicians who are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, they're taking audition after audition after audition, and they're losing audition after audition after audition, and they're banging their heads against the wall, and they're just going for it. And at some point, they may decide, like, I have a family now. I need to earn some money to, you know, feed myself and feed my kids. And they give up. I joke that, how many of you watch any of the reality, like, singing TV shows? You know, like, American Idol, Pop Idol, X Factor, all those things. I love the audition rounds when these people come in and they're like, you know, I'm God's gift to singing. And if I can't sing, you know, I'll have to give up on my dreams and I'll die. Like, that's kind of what I imagine, right? Like, it's these people that have these delusions based on having that calling. Some of them are talented, some of them aren't. But I do research on stuff that kind of cheese to them. Yeah.
You said you're a professional musician.
Yes.
So how did the research that you did relate to your life experiences?
Meaning how did my life experiences inspire all this research?
Yeah, did it correlate with what happened to you?
There's a joke in for social scientists, which is what all of your professors at the LSE are, that we either study kind of the thing that we are or the thing that's kind of the opposite of us. And so I kind of got this question I've gotten a lot over the years, like, do you have a calling toward music or do you have a calling toward, you know, organizational behavior? I would say that the best answer is that I and a lot of my colleagues who do research that is truly inspired by things we see in the real world, by puzzles that we see that intrigue us, and that's what caused us to go to graduate school to get PhDs. You know, it took me 6 years to get a PhD, like that's how long it takes us to get these degrees that allow us to become professors. That's after university. So we have to be excited about something in our field. And so in my case, it was this question of looking at all these musicians I was playing with and working with, wondering, like, why do all these very talented, you know, hardworking people make the decision to go into this career path? Where are their chances of making it are so low? And that was really the main question that kind of hooked me into wanting to understand this. So it's both personal and intellectual. Yeah.
How many business startups have you seen from people in this course in the past? Anyone entrepreneurs?
So I don't have a quantitative answer to that, in part because this program is currently in its second year. So we haven't had any graduates from the BSc in management program yet. So it changed, like the program has evolved over the years. It used to be something else, but the current second year students are the oldest cohort. So you guys would be the third cohort. So we don't have any graduates yet. I do know that there is, I know this more anecdotally from talking to students, that there is an active scene of students that are interested in startups, and I think there's a club that's about entrepreneurship, and they get speakers coming in, and that sort of thing. But that's a question you can ask to some of the people that are off. I'm just a faculty member who teaches in this program, or on the program, so that's something to ask of some of them as well. Looks like you have another question or comment on
that. Oh, I've been there. I was in the second or third medium.
Yeah, so this is a brand new program. So
the second study, right?
What?
The second study. The people studying management. The first study was the musicians.
Sorry, we're talking about like your LSC. Actually, this the program you guys have applied to and gotten into with the BSC in management, it's only existed for 2 years. So there's a lot that's been changing and evolving. So, for example, if you talk to the current second year students, they may tell you, yeah, I took this course, MG, blah, 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 and it was great or it sucked or whatever it might be. It may really change. Like, we've really been trying to be responsive to what's working. I continue that, and I'm not working trying to really change that. So this is a young program in a very old institution. So
is it modules made up from different subjects from the university or kind of office?
No, I mean, it's made up of many existing things. So, like, I showed you the slide in the beginning, but this course or this program does involve, you know, economics, statistics, things that, you know, have obviously been getting taught here for a long time. And some of those you will take with students from other degree programs. And then we have a lot that are just for you guys, like the course I've been teaching, the Intro Organizational Behavior course. Actually, I've been teaching upstairs in a room that looks exactly like this to only the BSc management students. So it's kind of a combination. And then you have electives that you can take later on in the program. So these are good questions. I don't know the details to tell you, so these are good questions for the heads of the program. Other questions? I think we're out of time. I like to end things right on time. So please come see me if you have questions. Also, we have a